You're listening to Frank Prattle. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to WPS1 Art Radio, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate at www.wps1.org. You might also be listening to the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery website at sfacgallery.org. And let's hope you're listening to frankprattle.com. We are currently located in the California College of the Arts here in San Francisco, California, and we're in, I would assume, it's a bunker? It appears to be
the basement of a bunker.
Basement of a bunker.
If there's an art riot, this is where everyone hides.
Yes, this is the ground zero leveling room. But there also appears to be some drilling in a neighboring room, so if you hear something in the background, now you know what it is. Or you can, you know, make up your own games for what that sound might be as well. Anyway, this program today is public versus private, and I have two amazing guests with me today, Rennie Pritikin, who is the director of the Nelson Gallery at UC Davis. Hi, Rennie.
Hi.
And we have Jens Hoffman as well, who's the director of the Wattest Institute at California College of the Arts, where we are listening to drilling right now. Hey, Jens.
Hello.
Maybe we can just start out with you giving a brief introduction of who you are and what it is that you do.
This is Rennie, and I have been at UC Davis for almost 4 years now. Before that, I was the chief curator at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, also in San Francisco. And before that, I was the director of New Langton Arts in San Francisco. So my whole career has been in Northern California, where I've specialized in experimental work, supporting new artists, and interdisciplinary work, and also working with popular culture, visual culture, material culture, bring that into the realm of the museum.
Sounds good. Jens, yourself?
I am a curator, exhibition maker, writer. I've been working here in San Francisco at the Wattest Institute for about a year now. Was previously living in London for 4.5 years, where I was working as the director of exhibition of the Institute of Contemporary Arts, and I've been working as a curator for about 10 years now. And one of my main concerns has been looking at how to diversify exhibition models, conceptualize exhibition making, and that's something that I hope to be able to continue here in San Francisco.
Lovely. One of the things that immediately drew me to pair you guys together is that in addition to, you know, having long and illustrious careers behind you, you both tend to be working right now in an institutional context, in universities or colleges or things like that. Tell me a little bit about what it's like, running a university gallery or a school associated gallery with what it was like, you know, working outside that field beforehand. Ready? Yourself?
Well, it's all about audience. I remember when the Wattest started, I was talking to Larry Rinder, the first director, and I asked him why he was leaving the Berkeley Art Museum, where he was chief curator, to become director of this. And he said, well, he was really excited because he had been given permission to make the audience totally internal, that he didn't have to think about the general public at all, that his audience was the students and other faculty, and he was really excited about that. And I was really taken aback. It was so unhip. It was the opposite of the direction of the art world, which was all about, you know, accessibility at that point. But that's no longer true, is it? I mean, that's not your mission, is it?
I think to a certain degree, it's definitely the mission. And yeah. I think that having arrived here and now being here a year, I feel like, you know, I mean, I should probably be really honest about it. I feel like that the Wattest, in the way I've experienced it over the last year, it, somewhere deep inside of itself, has a little bit of a schizophrenic existence. There is a bit of an identity crisis in terms of that institution. And I'm really actually quite excited about putting that institution on the couch and analyzing it and listening very carefully what the problems are, you know, and how maybe, you know, we can find a way of, like, addressing, yeah, not only the internal audience, the students and the faculties, but really also having a position within the community here in San Francisco, because that's really what surprised me the most. the waters. And that has probably to do with the previous director, Ralph Rugolf, who's now in London at the Hayward Gallery, and Matthew Hicks, who were very well-known international curators. In London, everybody knew what the waters was and what the program of the waters was. And you would go to New York, and it was a similar thing. And then you come to actually the hometown of the waters, and you say, oh, I'm the director of the Waters Institute. And people wonder what this is. And don't know anything about it. And I wasn't really aware of that, you know. And it's obviously an interesting case, you know, that there's, I wouldn't call it a disappointment, but it definitely was a surprise.
Well, that seems to be something that follows me my whole career. That
what exactly?
Well, when I was at Yerba Buena, the Center for the Arts in downtown San Francisco, that was one, you know, people would complain all the time that they got in a cab and said, take me to Yerba Buena, and the driver would say, what? And, you know, and certainly spending my youth being the director of a New Langton, where we got some award from the Business Arts Council for best organization or something, and they have this huge dinner, and or luncheon, rather, with 1,000 people, and I stood up to get the award, and I said, well, it's nice to get this award because we've been making the transition from persistent rumor to, well, I can't remember the joke, but, you know, to another form of rumor. And so I've always, and now I'm at this 25,000 student university. And if you take 10 steps out the door of the museum and ask the students walking by, 9 out of 10 will say, there is no museum. So, I mean, that speaks to a lot of questions of who we are and what we think we're doing.
Do you find yourselves both curating then with the students and teachers in mind, or, you know, as Rennie, you were saying, with a broader audience in at the forefront of your thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's a very complex answer. There's no one answer because it depends on the artist that you're working with and the intentions of show to show. I certainly take it as a challenge to find the language that the students are speaking, because this is not an art, you know. One of the many differences is that Jens is at an art institution, I'm at a liberal arts university that's actually oriented towards science and medicine and agriculture, so the arts are really obscure on this campus, but students, you know, 20-year-olds are 20-year-olds, and you know, what are they interested in? They're interested in text messaging, and they're interested in internet, and they're interested in music, and so
sex too, hopefully, yeah.
Yes.
Where did this come from?
Well, I mean, if we're going to make a list, we can make a lot of, I mean, piercings and tattoos
definitely.
You know, all this. But so I think it is the role of the institution, not in every exhibition all the time, but to try and speak that language to some extent. And also, you know, if you want to step back and speak, you know, more abstractly, you know, they're very at ease with cut up thinking. And juxtapositions, and I think by and large the arts have not caught up with that. That's one of the reasons I admire what Jens has been doing here, is that he's really trying to manifest that kind of thinking in his shows.
Jens, yourself, when you put together a show, who do you think about, especially now after having kind of a year to readjust yourself, you know?
Well, as you know, obviously, when you make an exhibition, you kind of have to plan in advance. And I think that some of the shows that we have been rolling out now were really kind of still based on an idea that I maybe had of the waters that might not actually really match up with the realities of it. But this has probably to do also with my experiences of working at the ICA in London. And I think, some of the contrast could almost... I mean, at least if you think about North America and Europe, the contrast couldn't be bigger. From an institution that has 500,000 visitors a year, you come to an institution that has maybe 10,000 visitors a year on a good day.
Good
you know, but I think maybe there's a sort of like longer story behind all of this, and it is appropriate to speak a little bit more about this, and which I feel finding myself here is probably part of a larger sort of process and a larger development that has to do with a lot of changes within the art world that have probably happened over the course of the last 10 years, basically the time I've been involved with art. On the one hand, really looking at changes that relate to the practice of curating, but also the changes and shifts in the landscape of institutions and the relationship between art and the audience. Art has never been more popular. There has never been a bigger interest in art than there is right now. So that really brings on different demands onto institutions. And I think coming from London, where I think there's probably no other city in the world where this is more extreme right now. When you think about the enormous success of Tate Modern with 5 million visitors a year. Well, when I was at the ICA, the chair of the board would ask me, Jens, look, 5 million visitors at Tate Modern here. It's like the headline in The Independent. How do we get there? It's like, well, give me $50 million and a star architect, and might be on our way. So then you kind of are in this kind of situation where you may be kind of like subtly pushed to create a certain program that might not necessarily be what you really have in mind, and you kind of don't really want to go the spectacular way, the sensational way, the populist way, and you think about alternatives. And then I'm kind of looking around me, I feel there's quite a number of curators who all of a sudden sort of like made that step, am I going to go and continue working anonymously within a large museum such as Tate or MoMA, or do I maybe go and move into a completely different direction? And for me, the interesting thing about being at the Waters was really the connection to the college. I've always enjoyed teaching. I've always been enjoying working with students. And in a way, I hope that in the future we will be able to collaborate much more and make those boundaries between what the Waters and what the CCA is much less visible. And one of the things that I'm talking to the chair of the curating department right now is how we could possibly integrate some of the exhibitions that the curating students are working on into the program of the Waters, and not simply really only by handing over the galleries to the students, but really seriously collaborating on what this could be, because ultimately, of course, the Waters is a public art space and we need to deliver professional program, but I think that this can still happen within scenarios of working with students, working with faculty, just being more experimental. And this is probably the strength that the Waters has, that we are not that determined on how many people come through the door, which ultimately then of course are also an indicator of how much money we are going to be able to raise, and these kind of things of course are all connected. Still, we have to raise money, we have to write grant proposals and all these kind of things just like everybody else. But still, there's more of a space for that allows you to experiment.
Yeah, I have to say, nobody at Davis has ever said anything to me about the attendance, which is about 5,000 a year, which is on a campus of 25,000. If you get 10,000, I don't know how many of those are students, how many are the general public, probably 50-50 or something. But of my 5,000 a year, it's about 50%, maybe 60% students and 40-50% the public. But yeah, you are. One of the positive things is it's free, right? So you're not generating income, which brings its own pressure. And you do have, you're on, my background is interdisciplinary, and what is more of an interdisciplinary medieval model than a university where you have access to some of the greatest minds? Davis, UC Davis is a great international university, and especially there's a virtual reality lab there's a raptor center There's a raptor center for injured birds from all over Northern California. That's incredible, to walk through that and be within inches of bald eagles and great horned owls and golden eagles. There's a marine mammal center that I'm talking to them about collaborating. So there's... And I've done something in my 3.5 years, I've done something like 40 or 42 different partnerships with on and off campus people. So that's the one of the great attractions at a major university. I don't know if you can't quite do that, but my next show is a collaboration with an art history professor who's a sinologist, and she's guest curating this show of propaganda posters from the People's Republic of China from 1949 to 1989 that's coming from Shanghai. And that's something that I would never have thought of or really done, but having this art history professor to collaborate with has been terrific. And we're doing a national symposium of people who study contemporary and modern Chinese art history to talk about it. So that's something that happens on a university campus that doesn't happen at SF MoMA, for example.
Right, right. Well, you bring up guest curating, which is definitely something that I'm interested in. Is what's the role that both of you find for guest curating? Not only, you know, bringing people into your setting, but also, you know, going outside and maybe, you know, mixing up things, you know, throwing a brick through the other guy's window, what have you, you know?
Well, the question has the answer inside it, is that we haven't talked about it, but Jens and I are both director curators. We do all the administration, and we also do the curating, which is
a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, but it's an interesting model, and I think it works up to a certain scale. And past that, it's not possible, but you know, even at Yerba Buena, I felt like things would get really predictable and boring. It wasn't the Rennie Pritikin Center for the Arts, so I let my junior staff curate, and I did lots of guest curating, and that's something, that's a model that I really developed. I don't know if you're going to do this with the students, which might be interesting to talk about, but I had a policy of working with amateur curators who had ideas but no experience, and some of our best shows were people who just called and said, I want to do a show, and I've never done a show, and what do you think? We did a show on bicycle culture with this bicycle nut, you know, and we did two or three shows like that were really special. We did a surfing show with a surfer, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So I think it serves to diversify the point of view, and you know, it's something that I imagine we both try to do is curate against our own taste. I don't know if you do that or not, but I find myself having to do that just to keep things lively. But if you have a guest curator, then
all right, Jens, yourself, guest curators, both you know, inside, you know, and outside.
I really like this idea that you were talking about in regards to amateur curators or outside curators in that sense. It sounds really interesting. I have, however, most of the time made rather bad experiences when I experienced curators working in institutions that I was working in. And that's mostly stemmed from the situation where you have people coming in with little experience, but maybe a bit of experience. And how do you negotiate what maybe the institution's needs are and what the expectations of a guest curator are. And this is normally where I always, you know, see the conflict appearing. And I think something that has to be looked at very carefully. I have done a lot of guest curating myself, been guest curator in many museums, and it took me a while to figure out how this would work the best, you know, because I realized, like, once I was inside an institution, what it actually meant and what kind of like necessities there are. So I think now, when I'm guest curating shows in other institutions, I have a much better sense of, you know, what I'm actually supposed to do and what I'm expected to do and what my role within this is. I think that the Waters itself is really too much. Too small of an institution that I would actually have to bring in outside curators at this point.
Well, what about Paul McCarthy, who just curated, I mean, the last show here?
Well, I think that maybe when you think about guest curators, it is what what you were saying in regards to director, curator, and at some point it maybe becomes too much and I bring in guest curators to sort of like get a little bit of the work off my back. Whereas if I invite Paul McCarthy to curate an exhibition here, it has a completely different motif behind it. Here I was interested in an artist that I originally wanted to do a show with. We kind of talked more about it, and at some point Paul said to me, Jens, why don't we actually do something completely different and I curate a show rather than you curating a show of my work? And I felt that was very appropriate, particularly because he had been living in San Francisco and was a student here. And when you go through the show, you see all these artists that have this local connection that he selected to be in the show. So somehow this really became an exhibition that seemed to be very much in the spirit of my own kind of interest. I've always been looking at artists who curate. It has been always a really big inspiration for me, because artists just really work differently when they, as a curator, when they put together a show, and somehow maybe don't feel so many constraints, and maybe don't take on this grid of rules that sometimes you have to as a curator, and they go into all kinds of directions. So it's sort of very inspiring to see this. But of course, if an artist curate, I don't expect them to fill out the loan forms. I don't expect them to do all of this. I know I have to do it. And in the end, it's kind of like curating the curator artist, if you will, because of course they don't want to even be bothered with all of this either. So that's a different model. But if you have a curator come in as a guest curator and you still have to do all of these other things, then it kind of becomes a problem.
I come out of the artist-based movement where, for the first 10 years at Langton, only artists curated, and usually collectively. So, and that worked at that institution at that time in history. But and it was fun and it was great training. But the joke I used to say was that most artists are great curators until they run out of people they went to school with. And then you have to make that leap to being really a professional thinker about art. But some artists really, two of my favorite curators are Jack Hanley, who's a painter, and Nayland Blake, who's done some incredible, sensitive, insightful shows, both here in San Francisco and then in New York.
One of my favorites is an artist who, internationally renowned, that Jens, you actually had curate a show, John Bach. Maybe you talk a little bit about working with him on that show that you had at the ICA and kind of that. I'm definitely interested in the artist as curator and how that feels, working with him. Is there any kind of, cockfighting animosity style, or is it tend to be fairly, fairly mutual and copacetic? But first, John Bach.
Well, obviously there's a long history of artist-curated exhibitions. It's not something that, I came up with or anybody here at this table came up with, and it goes back to the sort of like 19th century salons in France. And really the thing that have always been most fascinating to me was really like, why do artists take matter into their own hands, and what kind of types of shows are there actually that artists curate? And I kind of like this idea of also artists saying, well, I don't, I'm not going to sit here and wait around for a curator to come along or a gallerist to come along. I just, take over a space and I mount a show and I put some friends in there. And one of the probably most famous examples of this is the Frieze exhibition that Damien Hirst organized together with some of the students from Goldsmiths College in 1991, which then, launched the career of many of those people.
See, and I thought you were going to say the Times Square show. It's a generational thing.
I thought you were going to say the Salon des Refusés.
I think in recent history, I think that probably would have been one of the most well-known examples, especially, for me coming from London, where the young British artists had such a powerful impact on the transformation also of the English art scene. But yeah, there's definitely many, many examples. Group Material has curated some of the most outstanding exhibitions that I know of.
That's the Times Square show.
Let's go back to the Independent Group in the 1950s at the ICA and then the Whitechapel. those were amazing exhibitions. And at that point, the independent group, Richard Hamilton, those people were actually in charge of the ICA. I mean, that whole thing was run by artists at that point, you know. So going back to that history was something that interested me when I started working at the ICA. And in that kind of vein was also the invitation to John Bock to come and curate an exhibition at the institution.
I always, my prejudice is that artists curate differently than art historians. And I prefer the artist approach. And I've usually hired artists when I've been in a position to hire a curator.
It's interesting that you say art historian.
As opposed to curator.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
And this is a very American thing.
How so? Elaborate.
Well, one of the things that I noticed now, having worked here for the last year, and I mean, I have worked a lot in the US before, and I worked also in other institutions and on the East Coast in New York, is that curating is really understood as an academic profession in the United States. Or
I think of that as a European thing, that you have to have a PhD in.
Not at all. I mean, this is a funny thing. Like, think of the most innovative curator of the last 50 years, and who comes to mind? I mean, from my perspective, it's Harald Zeman. Harald Zeman didn't have a PhD. He never studied art history. And, you know, his probably most well-known protege, Hans-Ulrich Obrist, he studied economy, never finished school as a sort of, you know, university dropout, mm-hmm. and also, you know, an incredible force when it comes to transformation of curatorial practice over the last couple of decades.
Right.
I kind of felt like if you say, okay, there's the artist who curates and there's the art historian who curates, I kind of like all of a sudden find myself
in the
like
middle.
Being in the middle, you know? I mean, I kind of like relate to the creativity of the artist, but at the same time, of course, I also relate to maybe sort of like an analytical understanding of art and a sort of like, you know, historical understanding of it. But I kind of like to mix these things up and you know, always spoke about this idea of you know, the curator as an author, you know, as a sort of more creative individual rather than someone who, you know, is taking care of a collection and displays it in historical fashion, and mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, I think back, thinking about guest curators, that one of my favorite shows I did at Yerba Buena was a guy who was a graphic designer, called me up and said that he found out that the guy who was the boxing writer for the San Francisco Chronicle was very elderly and retired. And his house was filled from the basement to the attic with boxing memorabilia. And I did a show of his collection, you know, and it was incredible. And we did a little bit of art about boxing, too. But we learned so much about the history of San Francisco, which was the hotbed for boxing in the turn of the last century, and that how a lot of the boxing cartoonists from the newspapers came out of San Francisco, and this guy named Tad, but then also Rube Goldberg had been a boxing cartoonist in San
really?
Francisco.
Really?
Yeah.
One of my personal favorites from
there
a young
you
age.
Yeah. And this was brought to me by an artist because they see the world in a special kind of way. There's an anecdote I'd like to tell that Yerba Buena was supposed to be in its early years, especially the programs were supposed to have an emphasis on the diversity of the region, and we really tried very hard to confront that mandate, and it was very difficult. But I remember that I saw one of the guards who was Filipino before the opening. I was walking through the show, and he was staring at this wall and clearly was emotionally moved. And I looked over his shoulder, and he was looking at a picture of Kid Manila from 1910. In San Francisco, and kind of the light bulb went off. And that remains kind of as a signal or signpost for me about curatorially being open to outside the box thinking.
You had mentioned a little bit earlier as well an idea that I'm particularly fond of, and that's curating against your own taste, or going against the grain, as you put it, I think.
Yeah.
How often do you guys find yourself doing that, where you're looking at, you know, an artist, maybe, you know, an idea for a show, and you're like, yeah, I don't like it. Yes, let's do it. Like, you know.
I think it's very difficult. Recently, I picked up a book that someone gave me many years ago, and I never had the chance to read it, and I don't know why I picked it up right now. It's a biography of Marcel Duchamp. And I was starting reading it and thinking about the work again and looking at it and getting really into it. And I could just not believe really what kind of a big step forward this man did. And when I compare most of the art that I see out there right now with that radical step that Duchamp did, it just all fades away. And so I kind of like often find myself really thinking, what am I actually going to do in the, you know? Like, I mean, you know, how you know, where do I see something that is so strong and so radical and so out of the box like that again? I, you know, and so I start struggling sometimes, you know, and if that's really like the measurement that I would apply to most of the things, I guess maybe the galleries would be empty at this most of the time. So maybe what I'm actually doing is really curating against my own taste, because there's actually things in the galleries, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I had to do this twice in my career. The first time was going from Langton, where we did nothing but performance and video and installation and very radical things, and then suddenly finding myself in 1992, 93 at a much larger public institution that had vast public expectations. And I got the job as an expert, and then I had to throw out everything I thought I knew and start looking at art all over again, because with this commitment to multiculturalism, diversity, whatever you want to call it, I had to really look at work that I hadn't looked at and try and find the value in it. And so that was a re-education process. And now I find myself in Davis, a very conservative community, rural community, people who love art generally love landscape. That's their passion, because it's one of the most special landscapes in the world.
About you? Do you like landscape?
I'm learning to love it more. Well, you know, you have to learn how to look and see what's academic, you know, what's just repeating what you've been taught, and what's trying to do something new. And I mean, there are people. I've done a survey. Like I did Bay Area. Now here, I'm doing Sacramento Davis, called Flatlanders. I did one 2 years ago, and I'm doing one right now as we speak. And there are people who say, "Don't, please, Rennie, don't include any landscape. Make a statement."
Right.
Talking about curating against taste, you know, if I see something that moves me, and I've never seen it quite done that way, you know, there's this, there's quite a few artists there who never get shown, who are doing interesting work. So yeah, I will include some landscape, and some weird stuff, you know. And I if I do some landscape, then I can go to the rock and roll clubs and find some 21-year-old who's doing really grotesque juxtaposed magazine kind of stuff and include him as well.
Good, mixing it up. one of my favorite people in the entire world, and you know, I kick myself and my entire family that I was not born early enough to ever meet the man, is John Cage. And really looking at ideas of silence that John Cage had, I'd like to ask you guys, What you feel kind of the role of space or not putting things in when you curate is at the gallery. And I know it kind of dropped that on you all of a sudden, but you know, that's what friends are for.
I actually didn't understand the question.
Okay, so when you're curating,
yeah,
how important do you think it is to put space or to have a room for, you know, interpretation? Where there's nothing filled in that space, you know what I mean? Or silence, if you will. Kind of a stumper.
Yeah.
I'll tell you an anecdote. I met Cage.
He's the rescue song.
And this was in late 60s. I was a student. And I can't remember. This was after a concert collaboration with Cunningham, and he was taking questions, you know, standing around on the floor, and somebody asked him about Vietnam, and I can't remember what the question was, but his answer I remember 40 years now. It's been. Somebody asked him about, you know, this was just noise. And he said, well, let me stop you there. He said, I don't distinguish between noise, sound, and music, because then you start not being open to the possibilities of the world, and you start seeing things in pre-prescribed ways, and you end up thinking about the world like Viet Cong and not Viet Cong.
Right, right.
And that just was so beautiful and profound, that formulation that just came out of him. And so I think the answer to your question is that I think all of us post-Cage curators, one of our goals is to help people use their eyes in non-prescribed ways, being open and sensitive to the world.
Sounds good. Jens, yourself, what do you think?
So moving on to a different question, one that, you know, kind of, you know, even tougher than this one, is why? You know, there's a million things going on. The internet is bumping with information right now. Investment banking, you know, although having a recent setback in the past couple of weeks, the Fed's just cut some percentage points, so it's actually looking like it's on the up and up, might be profitable again. Why art? You know, especially, you know, the curatorial level of art, you know, it's definitely not the moneymaker of the century. You know, there are many other things that you could be doing with your life. You're both brilliant men. What draws you to this?
Well, as I said in the beginning, through the whole proliferation of the art world, I think also the art market really has become so much bigger. And I think there's probably been never a better moment to make money in the arts than now. But unfortunately, that has nothing to do with what we as curators do or critics do. The people who mostly benefit from this are the art dealers, I suppose, and luckily also the artists.
Maybe a few banks.
Yeah, or investors. I mean, using art as for speculation, I think, is also a big, big thing. But I kind of ended up in this whole thing really by accident. I originally studied theater, and I wanted to become a director in theater. And then all of a sudden, I kind of discovered certain artists working in theater, you know, mainly from the beginning of the 20th century, sort of like, again, like, and Randy was saying, like, you know, there are no categories between these different disciplines, and like really embracing a more interdisciplinary notion of what art could be. And I sort of like realized that maybe visual art and the discourse around visual art was something that attracted me more maybe than what I was hearing and seeing at that point around theater. And I met an incredible curator at that point called Kaspar Koenig. And I was able to work with him for a year, and I think I saw certain qualities in what he was doing that I felt were actually quite similar to what my understanding of making theater was. And I kind of sometimes think that maybe the what I do as a curator is somehow, somewhere a continuation of the practice of a theater director. And I mean this in a sort of like, you know, in a very collaborative way, rather than in a sort of like the idea of the director as a, you know, dictator, where we go back to this idea of the author, a sort of creative individual there. But sometimes I think that the relationship I have with artists and the discussions that we have might be actually similar to those, you know, of a theater director and an actor while developing a character, you know, where you maybe have a particular concept which could be, you know, similar to a script and the artist responds to that, and you sort of like have a dialogue about it, and then you sort of, you know, bring this all together in the format of an exhibition. And then the audience enters into all of this, you know, and plays its part, you know, and becomes sort of active in this environment.
I totally agree, you know, that at openings, people are always trying to think of what to say, you know, and the my least favorite is when they say, "What's your next show?" Like, you just opened the show. But what I have said frequently in the last few years is that it's an amazing thing that I can't even get my head around to be sitting at your desk and, you know, thinking. And 2 years later, hundreds of people are there. Artists are gathered. Artwork is gathered. People are writing about it, reading your wall text. From that sitting at your desk to that very social moment is an incredible arc that, I don't know if it's producer, director, but it's a thrill. It's very special and it's very satisfying. Like you, I didn't come from visual arts. I started as a poet and still am a poet. And I see myself in that tradition of poet curators like Frank O'Hara, Bill Berkson, Peter Sheldahl, who write, you know, about art, maybe not curate, but poets who took up the art world. And so that was my approach. But I'm a 60s guy, and so art to me was about a way to go to work and earn a living and be part of a social action, and not exploiting people, but serving the community. So that's how I got into it, and there's still a part of that for me. You know, now, as you said earlier, being a teacher is an incredibly meaningful way to share your expertise and be in the world.
Well, I think that's a beautiful note to leave it on. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. You're listening to WPS1, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate at www.ps1.org. You might also be listening to the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery website at www.sfacgallery.org. And let's hope you're listening to frankprattle.com. Today, my extra special guests, who kicked some serious ass all over this bunker in the bottom of CCA, Rennie Pritikin, the director of the Nelson Gallery at UC Davis. Thank you, Rennie. And Jens Hoffman, the director of the Wattis Institute here at California College of the Arts. Thanks, Jens.
Thank you very much to our very special host.
Thanks.